lots to do, little time to do it. You guys are the ones who are always here. I don't care about them. They never come. So I will share this with you, and they can be the fools. Like I mentioned, I'm not going to be here on Thursday. Right? I told you about that. I've already recorded the video. I'm going to make it available when I get home tonight, so you'll have the ability to basically get the class. But here's where I screwed up. I was told by the registrar back in January that the last day of classes was the 9th, which is Thursday. Because if you look on the academic calendar, the last day to make up exams is the 10th. And the way the college has always done it is the last day of classes is the day before the last day to make up finals. Well, apparently, that was wrong. Apparently, the last day of classes is Tuesday, the 7th. So, it's no big deal, because now somebody gets to take the final and doesn't get the senior skip ability. But that means that I also have less time to get the final done. Working on it, already get the essays written, starting to get the multiple choice, so it will be up and running for you on Tuesday. The final exam will open up at 8 o'clock in the morning and it will remain available till 11:59 p.m. So, in lieu of having to come to class and listen to me on Tuesday, you got to spend the weekend watching the video. Now, here's the problem. In order for me to finish the material, I had a class and a half left. So instead of the video being 75 minutes, it's like 110. But I finished the class. I got it all done. So I'm definitely going to suggest that you watch it over multiple sittings. I mean, I can talk and talk and talk and talk. That's not a problem for me. And the worst part is as I was recording it, I started talking even faster because I was nerding out and I was really getting into it. So I know watching the videos is probably excruciating for you, so I definitely recommend, like I said, I'm going to make it available tonight. Watch it over the course of a couple of days, because your exam will go all the way to the end. And I may do something cruel, like put a disproportionate amount of questions from the end on the final. Not that I would ever do anything like that. But we got to bring the war to an end somehow, so that's how we're going to do it. So what does this mean? Well, like I think I said, I wasn't able to get the papers yet, but I think everybody in here has submitted the papers for this class, so nothing to worry about. Only one of the people that didn't submit it is one of the people that's like hardly ever here, so I don't really care. I'm not going to lose any sleep over it. I will get to your papers. So I'll be honest with you. I'm working on your exam now. So I will be working on your exam until it's done. And then when I'm done writing your exam, that's when I'll start grading the papers. And what I will do is I'll grade them in the order that they came in. So basically, I will open up my email because I get notifications when you drop them in the drop boxes. And I will go back and I will start there. So if you get your papers in on like the Thursday or early on Friday, you'll hear from me sooner than if you got it to me later on Friday or the end. The way things look, I'm coming home on Sunday night. I'll probably sleep a little late on Monday because I don't think I'm due to land in Providence until midnight. You never know. I usually wake up at 5 no matter what anyways. But I plan on spending Monday just grading papers. So you know, I spend about 20 minutes per paper. It's about what it takes me. So I'm going to try to get in some here or there. But chances are on the Monday, I'll get through the bulk of them. And then whatever I don't get done on Monday, I'll finish on Tuesday. So while you're taking the exam, I'll be grading your papers. I'm not going to look at the exams, obviously, until Wednesday. So just don't forget. Although I'm going to be looking for somebody's exam, like the first minute I wake up on Wednesday, because someone's grade has to be in by noontime. Or maybe I could forget.
Just give me a day.
Wait, don't you have like a C in here? No, you don't. I know you're doing fine. Well, let's see if you can finish. That's all. See if you can finish. All right, so that's what I got. Any questions on any of that? So Josh did ask me about doing extra credit. Don't forget, you still have the ability to do the extra credit. So if you didn't do well on an exam or two, I will give you until next Friday to submit movie reviews. Remember, that was the big assignment that I've talked about a couple of times. So if you watch a movie about World War I and give me a 2 to 3 page movie review, I will count that as extra credit. So you've had me before with the extra credit. It gets added into the sum, and then when I divide it, basically all of the points, all the grades rise. Yes.
So I actually made a YouTube short about Bella Wood. Would that count as extra credit?
No.
No? Damn it.
No, I don't want to watch anything.
It's like 30 smart. Seconds.
Honestly.
Yeah, that was
literally 30 seconds.
That was good. I'll watch it.
YouTube short.
If you send it to me, I'll watch it. I'll get a chuckle out of it, but that's about it. Clever, though. Nice try.
Oh, a lot of work in that shit, too. It's my highest.
How about the books? Like, you know how, like, we have to read books and then, like, answer questions?
Well, yeah. Did you buy All Quiet on the Western Front?
Nah.
Did you buy that book? Well, then there you go. So you can't do it. But you can watch the Netflix movie. And do a movie review of that. 1917. I think that's on... Is that on Max? I don't remember where I saw that. Maybe it's on Prime.
I think it's on Netflix.
Is it on Netflix? So 1917. When they were young. What?
It says it's on Max and Netflix. When they Shall Not Grow Old was on Max.
Yep. They Shall Not Grow Old. That's a good one. I like that one. Das Boot is World War II. There's a whole bunch of them. Just do a search. World War I movies. And you know, you could review.
Do you have any clue if any of them would be on Disney Plus?
Probably not.
Ah, okay. Well, I mean, they own like everything now, so.
Right. But maybe on Hulu, if you have the joint subscription?
Yep.
Not sure.
All right.
So there's that. So like I said, those will be due 1 week from Friday. I'll give you some extra days to do it. Because I don't have to have my grades in until the following Monday, but my goal is to get them in on the Friday. Because next week I have a cheese week, but then the following week I have a week from hell. So I will be doing that stuff. All right. I got to get rolling. I got a lot to cover today. We have a sudden counterstrike to the massive wave of German offensives. Beginning with Operation Michael, these offensives didn't amount to much other than creating a whole bunch of salients along the Western Front. But I think the mental image that I gave you, like popping pimples, what the Allies began doing was targeting those salients and essentially pushing back. And, much to the amazement of the Allies, they were suddenly winning. Of course, granted, the Germans were withdrawing as well. But the fact that they relatively easy were able to close in all of the advances that the Germans had got beginning in the spring, in basically a matter of weeks, was telling. And the Allies decided to make the computer work. Move things forward. But, interestingly enough, not the politicians. Beginning in around August, the politicians felt that the war was going to go into 1919. So they started planning, funding, munitions purchases, new drafts, basically preparing themselves to set up for another year of the conflict. So again, one of the most shocking things was they were absolutely convinced that the war would continue. Ironically, for an example, the Brit plan would actually call for a mobile offensive to be launched in the spring, where England would begin putting more tanks on the field than men. But what they were going to do is they had designed... God, crap, I forgot what it's called. They actually designed a light tank that was capable of going up to like 20 miles an hour. They used it in limited capacity. I forgot what it was called.
The Renault?
No, the Renault was French. You got to look up the British light tank. It was just a weird, weird looking tank. But it was effective, it was quick. And the Brits planned on mass producing them over the wintertime. And then in the spring at some point, or maybe into the summer, just letting the tanks go across the battlefield. and basically rolling over the Germans. So that's what they were focused on, building up their strength to do it again. Because they were absolutely convinced that the Siegfried line, or the Hindenburg line, was impregnable. But the generals had other ideas. Because the generals were getting their intelligence reports, and they suddenly realized that now is not the time to take the foot off the gas pedal, but rather to continue to charge forward. Because they didn't want to squander the initiative. If the enemy is retreating in front of you, you don't stop and don't let them get away. You pursue. Wait, you don't stop and let them get away. You continue to pursue. Grammar. Slow the brain down. Slow the mouth down, Lamanic. So in August, they launched the last offensive of the war, known as the 100-Day Offensive. Because guess how many days were left in the war when they started? Of course, they didn't call it the 100 days offensive when it started. They just went on the offensive. Essentially, what they did was focus on attack, 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 attack. Attack at many points on the battlefield as possible. Attack simultaneously, attack separately. But just continue to attack, forcing the Germans to constantly have to shift and move and reposition. And of course, killing them as well was also important. Because like Ludendorff believed in the spring, if they killed enough Germans, then that would convince the government to surrender. Or even possibly trigger a mutiny, like the French almost experienced in 1917. But at the least, maybe they could convince the Germans to move out of the Hindenburg lines. And if they could chase the Germans out of their own defensive positions onto the flat fields of Belgium, then they can make the war fluid. And possibly roll everything and head right towards Germany. So, strategically speaking, they bulked up their strength in three areas. The British, the French, and the Americans. And like a pincer, they were told to penetrate and curve and come together. They were going to try to engulf as much of the Hindenburg line as possible. And basically strangle those troops in to surrender. And pretty much once the German army was gone, then Berlin would negotiate. Now, what helped was cooperation, which was something that hadn't been present throughout the war. Because as I've alluded to a couple of times, Haig hated the French, Petain hated the British. But the one thing that seemed to mellow those leaders out was the presence of Pershing, Blackjack himself. He basically convinced Foch and Petain and Haig to stop playing politics. Fight and kill the enemy. That's how you win wars. And by the summer of 1918, that's what they committed themselves to do. Now, amazingly, this sudden turn of events absolutely shocked Berlin. They figured their relative success in the spring with their sequence of operations, that they could do what they did in 1914. That they essentially repositioned, then they could dig in and basically take possession of that land. They never thought that they would have to retreat back and give up all the ground that they gained in a matter of weeks. Army equals strong. Obviously, I screwed up the location on that. Ludendorff, as commander of the German army, of course, had all the numbers. Ludendorff realized that in terms of men and materiel, even if the Allies threw everything they had at the Hindenburg line, that it may be severed in some spots, but the overall operational strength of the German army would remain. And because their draft system was based on age, come spring of 1919, there would be another 637,000 men eligible for military service. So, essentially, they could recover the losses that they had from the year before. But Ludendorff also realized only delay inevitable. With the oomph of the 100-day offensive, the vivardo, the daringness, the brave, the boldness, he realized that the French were actually not on the verge of collapsing morale-wise. That, you know, the French got a couple of inches and that rejuvenated their fighting spirit. He also finally realized that the Brits were not going to bail. He believed that through for many years. That if you push the Brits a little too much, they will take their ball and go home. Well, they're clearly all in it. And by August, he suddenly realized, holy crap, the Americans can fight. And that America's strength was only growing. The United States had the largest population out of any of the belligerents. And boatload after boatload after boatload of doughboys was coming. So, he could build a new army with 600,000 or so new men, but how is that going to counter the potential millions of Americans that could potentially be there by 1919? In other words, he suddenly realized the math no longer made sense. Hold on, this is annoying me. And show. Where's Ludendorff? Ludendorff, go over here where you belong. Alright. Slideshow, go back to current slide. Yeah, there you go. That's where you're supposed to be. So, on October 1st, Ludendorff reported to the general staff that based on his calculations, the army was finished. And as a result, he actually said in his report that the final defeat was probably inescapably at hand. I never served, I never commanded men, and I never was a general, a commander-in-chief leading a war. I cannot imagine the thought process in which one day you believe that you are going to win and it's only a matter of time, only to suddenly realize in the next that catastrophe is at hand. I can't imagine that. That's what Ludendorff was going through. So, what does he do? Well, he then changes his position, his strategy. His new goal was not to allow Germany to be humiliated and to avoid a complete surrender, an unconditional surrender. You know, just as a juxtaposition, Germany, when they surrendered in World War II, we pounded that country into the ground. As bad as dropping two atomic bombs on the Japanese was, that was nothing compared to what we did to Germany. Look on the history of us firebombing every single city. Berlin, Dresden, literally flew over the city and dropped incendiaries, burned civilians alive, burned all the buildings and structures to the ground. We blew up all their railroads, their ports. If there was something to be blown up, we blew it up. Germany was destroyed. But that wasn't the case in World War I. So Ludendorff wanted to avoid an invasion that could result in battles taking place on German soil. So, how do you do it? Plus, he wanted to protect the core of German society. We didn't really get too deep into the politics of Bismarck. But when Bismarck made Germany, he took the 25 German states and basically put them in an alliance with Prussia at its core. And the core of Prussian society was the monarchy and the army. Being a Prussian noble himself, Erich von Ludendorff, he wanted to make sure the core of his country, Prussia, would be safe. So, how do you accomplish all this? Opportunity. He suggests that what we should do before the war ends is replace the monarchy with a parliamentary government. And that will allow the German people to blame politicians, not the Kaiser, not the army. Because at the end of the day, who will be in office when they sign the end of the war? Clever. And by the way, Ludendorff also believed that when this occurred, things would get so bad in Germany that the people would demand the restoration of the monarchy to save them. He was half right. Now, Ludendorff was not necessarily the cleverest guy. Where did he come up with this idea? Well, Woodrow Wilson suggested it. Wilson being the Protestant that he was, the virtue signaler, he gave Germany an opportunity to achieve peace without victory by literally extending an olive branch to Germany back in 1917. On January 22nd, 1917, after he got reelected, but before he took the oath of office for his second term, he announced before a joint session of Congress his intention to create his ideas, or rather he articulated his ideas, on how a meaningful peace could be achieved. He said, and I quote, "There must be not a balance of power, but a community of power. Not organized rivalries, but an organized common peace. It must be a peace without victory. Victory would mean peace forced upon a loser, and a victor's terms would be imposed upon the vanquished. It would then be accepted in humiliation, under duress, at an intolerable sacrifice, and would leave a sting, a resentment, a bitter memory upon which terms of peace would rest, not permanently, but only as upon quicksand." He called for a peace without victory. And I'm going to come back to League of Nations in a second. As I'm talking it through, I don't like the way it's aligned, so I'll have to edit that. Will I remember? No. Next time I teach this class in 4 years, I'll probably be saying the same thing. All right, anyways. Wilson said, "A true peace, a meaningful peace, a lasting peace, must involve three principles. The first, self-determination. Self-determination. The people should have the right to determine what kind of government they live under. They should be able to determine the nature of their country." Self-determination. He also called for freedom of the seas. If you recall, one of the things that pissed him off the most when America technically was neutral was the fact that England was stopping and impressing U.S. ships, violating the laws of neutrality. Well, Woodrow Wilson said, you can't have a peace if one nation can take the stuff of other nations. No, the seas should be free. The seas should be disarmed. And last but not least, disarmament. He said, no nation should have a standing army large enough to basically attack another. You should only have a defense force, an army strong enough to protect your borders and to keep outside invaders out. Why? Because that's peace. A peace where somebody doesn't live in fear of being attacked by someone else. Now, FYI, this olive branch was contained in his 14 points, which maybe you learned about in high school. This was the 14 points, the 14 measures upon which he articulated the way the post-war world should be set up to create a world where this war would be the war to end all wars, and that the world would be safe for democracy. To ensure this new world, he also called in the 14th point for the creation of a world body, which he called the League of Nations. This world body would be an assembly where all free nations could send delegates and they would have to engage in face-to-face diplomacy. Because Wilson recognized the truism about all mankind. If you have a gripe with somebody else, chances are you're not going to get in a fight if you're looking at each other face-to-face. Most people will reserve to acting tough or whatever, but eventually there'll be a cooling of the minds and you'll begin talking. So Wilson believed if you had this world body, any type of international dispute could be settled through diplomacy. And thus the aggressive nations would be intimidated into not being aggressive because they would be outnumbered. All of this pie in the sky. But after he laid out his 14 points, Wilson also basically tells Germany, look, we're not jealous of you. We don't want to destroy you. We want to extend our hand. And we want to work together through collaboration and fix the problems that led to the war. And this would be the point that Ludendorff went back and said, oh yeah, remember when the American president said this? This is what we want. Because within the 14 points are what I already said, self-determination, disarmament, and peace without victory. So in the minds of Ludendorff and the German government, they're sitting back and saying, this is our emergency strategy. This is how we're going to get out of it. This is how we're going to avoid humiliation, because Wilson has now brought America in and they're the heroes. And they will be able to check the Brits and the French. Because after all, who holds all their debt? Of course, the problem is that Woodrow Wilson did not think like Ludendorff and Hindenburg and the Kaiser. The German mind is a little different. So, they slowly began going through this process of transforming Germany. Well, of course, their men are still on the Western Front dying. The first step that they did was they would appoint Prince Maximilian von Baden as chancellor. He would be brought in on October 3rd, 1918. Now, ironically, Baden did not want the position. But the Kaiser personally convinced him to take the role. Why? He was a noble, but he was not active in the military. So this is meant to make it seem like the army is giving up control of Germany. It's a feint. So what does he do? Well, as chancellor, he can appoint all of the government ministers. So he intentionally begins bringing in representatives of the liberal political parties. The Social Democrats, the Center Party, the Progressive People's Party, and putting them in head positions in the cabinet. By the way, the cabinet hadn't been used really since 1915 because everything was taken over by the general staff. But now we're going to recreate the cabinet and politicians are going to be in charge, not military men. Then, Then, once he makes it look like we're going to be political, he then contacts Wilson. And he notifies the President of the United States that Germany, as of October 6th, is willing to negotiate an end of the war on the basis of the 14 points. Now, what's the hope? Well, Germany believed that, at most, they're just going to have to pull out of France and Belgium. Because under international law, they've already gained all the territory under Brest-Litovsk. And under international law, when you make a treaty with another country, that's viewed as legitimate. So Germany basically said, we already got our win, so we'll give up in the West and we'll enjoy the East. Even if we have to give up some of the East. But under international law, we have a right to those lands. So in other words, we get bargaining chips. Oh, they also hope to keep Alsace and Lorraine as well. Well, because Woodrow Wilson was an ally of England and France, of course he communicates to them that out of the blue, the German government contacted the United States. And when Clemenceau and Lloyd George heard about this, they were stunned. To a degree, they were angry. Because they recognized, if you start negotiating the post-war world before you end the war, that's dangerous. Because basically what you're going to do is you're going to give up any advantage that you have militarily. Because you already know what the outcome's going to be. Instead, they told Wilson, we're not going to go for a ceasefire. No parley. While we figure this out, we are going to continue the war until we put Germany in its place. 2-1. And why? Well, neither of them trusted Wilson. The two leaders had little tolerance for Wilson's piousness, his sermons, his virtue signaling. And they definitely didn't care about this notion that this peace without victory. They had been fighting for 4 years and they wanted spoils. Because if you read the 14 points, again, freedom of the seas, freedom to engage in international exchange, no tariffs, no restrictions, territorial shifts, self-determination. Remember, France, England, they're colonizing nations. Do you think they suddenly, just because Wilson said, oh, give up India, give up Egypt, give up Morocco, these countries are going to turn around and say, okay. So, they told Wilson no. And to get a leg up on Wilson, Clemenceau contacts Foch and tells him to draw up terms for a ceasefire. So let's end the war, then we'll negotiate. And Foch was told by his prime minister, get the moon. And that's what he did. The terms that Germany would be expected to accept to get armistice were designed to cripple Germany. I'm going to come back and I'm going to revisit them a couple of times. But I'll just lay it all right here, right now. Alsace and Lorraine, back to France. Germany, every last German soldier was to evacuate out of all occupied territory within 4 weeks. And they could not be within 6 miles of the German border. So they had to not only go back to Germany, but they had to go into Germany. And all of the bridges and all of the railways into Germany had to be left unguarded. Because those would be occupied by the Allies. In other words, the German army, which is in Belgium and France, now has to go into the interior of Germany. And suddenly the Allies can magically get into Germany. Plus, they also had to give up 5,000 artillery guns, 25,000 machine guns, 1,700 planes, 5,000 locomotives, 150,000 railway cars, all submarines and the bulk of their surface navy. Now, you're technically in the middle of the war, and these terms are freaking ridiculous. Foch intentionally designed them that way because he didn't want Germany to accept. Because he wanted to enact revenge on Germany. In other words, he wanted to break through the Hindenburg line and actually invade Germany and start blowing up German villages and towns and cities, making the German civilian population suffer like the French had. Never in his wildest dreams would he imagine that the Germans would even contemplate this. Because only a nation that's on the verge of complete loss would accept this. Well, after several weeks of squabbling, by the end of October, all three agreed, in theory, upon the terms that were drafted by Foch. They also agreed, in theory, that once armistice was achieved and Germany basically turned over its military capacity, then they could negotiate the post-war world based on the 14 points. But the way Wilson wrote the 14 points is a clever lawyer could interpret them to mean whatever they wanted. So for example, when England replied their response to the 14 points, they scribbled out freedom of the seas and they replaced it with the right to demand reparations for the violators of peace. So they took Wilson's points and made them more acceptable to the British and the French. Well, while this was going on, Wilson, out of the blue, hung a curve. He caught the Germans off guard, as well as the Allies. He knew what the Allies were doing with the 14 points. So he figured the only way that he could get what he wanted was to convince Germany to accept the 14 points. In a way to almost to paint the British and the French into the corner. But, and I don't know if it was intentional or not, in a series of diplomatic notes that went to Germany, each one started getting more and more aggressive. For instance, first said Germany should really consider an armistice. But then that was followed up with a statement saying that Germany should consider themselves militarily defeated. They also said that Germany should be able to be willing to give up whatever was necessary to secure an armistice and prevent a renewal of war. They also told Germany, you know, you should expect punishment for submarine warfare. I mean, after all, that's what got us into the war. We're not happy about it. And that the Belgians and the French weren't exactly pleased with all the destruction that occurred. So you're probably going to have to pay for that as well. But the one thing that shocked Germany more than anything was in his final note, when he basically undermined Ludendorff's plan. You know, again, think about what they were doing. They were going to keep the Kaiser. Now you have this chancellor who's not a military guy. Now you got a new cabinet. They're made up of politicians. Well, Wilson would reply that he would only deal with elected representatives of the German people, not the Kaiser, not somebody who, because of birth, gets special privileges. In other words, he sniffed out what the Germans are trying to do. Questions? Well, when Ludendorff received not only the proposal to get armistice, but also the notes that were sent by Wilson, Ludendorff became convinced that this amounts to an unconditional surrender. He realized suddenly that he fatally misjudged his enemy, and he demanded that the government break off all armistice negotiation. He became recommitted to fighting the war to the end. He also was terrified about what was going on in Russia. Rumblings of Bolshevism were being heard in the different quarters in Germany. Ludendorff was terrified if they surrendered their military capacity that they essentially would be opening themselves up for a Bolshevist-style revolution, which could mean the end of Germany. Hindenburg also took action. He would send out an appeal to the armed forces, the army in particular, and speaking to them on their behalf, he told the army that Wilson demands military capitulation. This, for us soldiers, is unacceptable. He tried inspiring the men to realize that if we agree to this, you're screwed. We all are. This would actually boost the fighting ferocity of the Germans in the last few days of the war. Well, that was until October 24th, when word reached Berlin that a bunch of sailors in the port city of Kiel had launched a mutiny. In an act of desperation, on October 24th, the German High Command ordered the Northern Fleet to prepare for a last-ditch, all-out naval battle to smash through the blockade. The plan was to sail the entire fleet into the English Channel and essentially devastate anything they came across. But the sailors suddenly realized that means we're going to die. And they didn't want to die. So, on several of the vessels, they began to refuse to obey orders. Some refused to weigh the anchor. Some refused to fire up the boilers. Some outright mutinied. Some engaged in acts of sabotage. But long story short, there were stories popping up on all the ships that there were individuals in small groups doing everything they could to stop the fleet from deploying. But then guess what the admirals did? A loyal torpedo boat sailed in and sunk one of the ships that had the most mutineers on it. Sunk it. Killed them all. Well, when that occurred, all of the rest of the mutineers surrendered. By November 1st, the naval command was moving ahead with the plans. Well, when that occurred, more sailors mutinied. And they did everything they could to break the ships. But some of the sailors on land reached out and communicated with the socialists and the unions that were in Kiel to try to make a Soviet, a council made up of sailors and trade unionists and socialists. On November 3rd, about 1,000 would gather on the docks for an anti-war rally. They would adopt the slogan, Freuden und Brot, freedom and bread, and basically demand an end to the war. Of course, the police came in and would attempt to break the rally. But in the melee, 7 were killed, 29 were injured. That caused a reaction on the next morning, when on November 4th, some 40,000 sailors on almost every single ship spontaneously rose up, started seizing controls of the ship, sailing the ships into the docks, making sure they were secured, leaving the ships, going down on the docks and joining with the mob. Within hours, they managed to seize control of the city, because the sailors brought with them guns, military rifles. And then this sudden revolution somehow spread to other coastal cities. Sailors stationed in other ports joined with socialists and unionists, and they started doing the same thing. And like dominoes, soon communists and socialists in Hanover, Frankfurt, Munich, all began rising up. The most successful was in Munich. A group calling themselves the Worker and Soldier Council actually forced the Bavarian king to abdicate. And by April 1919, this group actually declared Bavaria, to be a Soviet republic. That's how bad it got. So, when the trio learned what was going on throughout the country, they suddenly realized, the jig is up. That the soldiers were not going to fight to the end. So, they decided to take action. First step, they sent a politician, a member of the Center Party, which is a center-moderate party, a man by the name of Matthias Erzberger. He would travel by train and go here to the Champion Forest near the village of Picardy. There, he would meet with representatives of the Allies, and he would begin negotiating terms to implement an armistice. Why Erzberger? He was a politician, not a military man. Then on November 9th, you had a flurry of activity. First, Van Baden convinced the Kaiser to demand Ludendorff's resignation. Ludendorff, of course, agreed, and he was replaced as commander of the army by Wilhelm Groener. Unlike Erich von Ludendorff or Paul von Hindenburg, Groener was not a Prussian noble. He was a self-made military man, born of a commoner family, enlisted at a young age, worked his ass off, and achieved the rank of general through promotions. So, von Baden assumed his ascension as commander of the army would make the Allies realize, okay, civilians are in charge. But, interestingly enough, bye, Josh.
Yeah.
But Hindenburg would remain. Hindenburg actually suggested to the Kaiser that he should resign as well. But the Kaiser told him no. Because he was their George Washington. The Kaiser correctly believed that if he spoke to the army, the army could still, particularly the veterans, could be the mechanism to prevent a revolution. So he would remain on as supreme commander until the armistice was signed in June 1919. Biden then convinced the Kaiser to abdicate. Because again, Wilson's only going to talk to elected representatives. Now, while the Kaiser was willing to step down, he was hesitant because he didn't want to give up the monarchy of Prussia. Because he was not only the Emperor of Germany, he also was King of Prussia. But the problem was, is the German Constitution of 1871 said only the King of Prussia could be the Kaiser. So to give up one, meant he had to give up both. So after hours of debate, Wilhelm agreed. He would be put on a train and he would be shipped to the Netherlands, where he would remain until his death in 1941. Living in a nice estate along the North Sea, painting and whittling, carving. But interestingly enough, because this guy was such a brutal tyrant, he used to spend all the free time he could chopping down the trees on his estate, splitting the wood, and freely giving the wood to the poor people that lived in the village near his house. Because he's such an awful tyrant.
Oh,
yeah. And then, as if icing on the cake, once the general command was changed, once the Kaiser was gone, Baden himself would resign. Because he was a prince, Prince Maximilian von Baden. When he resigned, he transferred power to the head of the largest political party, a man by the name of Frederick Ebert. And to Ludendorff's original point, now the politicians are in charge. And it's November 9th, 1918. Who's going to get the blame? Well, November 10th, Erzberger reports back to Hindenburg all of the specific terms that the Allies are looking for. Interestingly enough, Erzberger actually suggested that we reject the terms because the terms were so outrageous. But Hindenburg tells them to accept the terms, regardless of how shocking they were. Word did not get to Erzberger until 5 a.m. on November 11th. At that point in the railroad car where they were working, Erzberger, on behalf of the German nation, would agree to an armistice. Which is what? What is an armistice? Is it a surrender?
Ceasefire.
It's a ceasefire. Okay, ceasefire. Now, FYI, because of the fact that Erzberger was the one whose signature was on the armistice agreement, he himself would be assassinated in 1921 for betraying the German soldiers. Just FYI. Now, under the armistice, it would go into effect at 11 a.m. on the 11th day of the 11th month. Word would go up and down the front lines that all shots were supposed to stop. At that point, Germany would begin evacuating France, Belgium, Alsace, and Lorraine, and would retreat back to the west bank of the Rhine. On that day, the German Navy would begin transferring its surface fleet and its submarines. And the Army would begin transferring over the artillery, the trains, the locomotives, the planes. All of which I mentioned before. But most importantly, they also had to accept the Rhineland was going to be occupied. So when the French and the British and the Belgians and the American troops began crossing the German borders, the German soldiers were not to fire upon them. All Allied POWs would be freed. All German POWs would be kept until the peace treaty was signed. But here's the big curveball that came out of nowhere. Foch added in, at the last minute, that Germany renounced the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. When Erzberger signed, he gave up Germany's claim to Finland, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, the Ukraine, and Belarus. All of the lands that, under an international law, were transferred by a legitimate treaty, now would be null and void. Shocking. But the war was over. We did the terms. Before I get to this, I got to read my favorite quote. Written by Philip Gibbs, a writer for the New York Times, in the late edition of non-November 11th. Because back then they used to do a morning edition and an evening edition. This quote was on the cover page. Last night, for the first time since August, in the first year of the war, there was no light of gunfire in the sky. No sudden stabs of flame through the darkness. No spreading glow above black trees, where for 4 years of nights, human beings were smashed to death. The fires of hell have been put out. But let's not forget, Germany was not defeated. They still had millions of men in uniform. Why did they do this? Well, simple. Russia was gone. They were killing themselves. And all the German troops had been diverted to the Western Front. But by November, Austria-Hungary was out of the war. The Ottoman Empire, out of the war. And remember, the U.S. was sending ship after ship after ship of men and materiel. And why the hell did they agree to this? It all goes back to what I said. The German people believed that by accepting the armistice, that they would be treated fairly. But were they? Well, you're going to have to wait and see. Questions, and then we're going to do the last round, and then we're done. No early today. I just want to finish up. All right, but what about the Allies? What the hell happened? Well, Germany had, as part of the Central Powers, Bulgaria, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the Ottoman Empire. Well, the first nation to be knocked out was Bulgaria. Beginning in September, the Allies finally took advantage of the birdcage on Salonika, the Greek front, and with all the strength that they could muster, bolstered by territorial soldiers, troops from India, troops from Egypt, troops from Australia, they launched an all-out offensive and basically rolled into Bulgaria, and the Bulgarians could do nothing to stop them. In fact, the Brits and the French advanced 120 miles in 2 weeks. They just kind of went, whoo! Considering they couldn't stop them, all they could do was basically surrender. Because keep in mind, the only reason why they were in the war to begin with was to secure that railroad line that Germany could use to send munitions down to Constantinople. So, within 15 days, they sued for armistice. And Bulgaria was out of the war. As for the Ottomans, they didn't do much better. They were dealing with an all-out assault by the British Expeditionary Forces, who had an alliance with the Arabs. Some 600,000 strong marched from Transjordan and Israel and started marching. They seized the city of Damascus and they continued to march to Aleppo, making their way to the capital of the empire itself. Ironically, much of this success was due to a British agent, T.E. Lawrence, commonly referred to as Lawrence of Arabia. He had been sent to Arabia by the British government in 1916, and his job was to basically fire up the Arabs using nationalism. Basically asking them, how come you're submitting to the Turks? The Turks want to genocide you, like they genocided the Armenians and the Assyrians and the Greeks. It's only a matter of time before they come and try genociding you. Now, was that true? Probably not, but it scared the bejeebus out of the Arabs, enough for them to raise an army and join the cause. And as they joined, the British began bringing in ship after ship after ship of rifles and bullets and other munitions. So soon, they liberated not only the entire Arabian Peninsula, but allowed them to blast into the Middle East and into modern Turkey itself. Well, when word came at how easily they took Damascus, the Ottoman regime basically agreed to an armistice because they knew what was coming. And on October 30th, the Ottoman Empire was out of the war. As for the Austro-Hungarian Empire, they really should have been out of the war in 1917. The fact that they made it into 1918 is a miracle in itself. They had lost so many men due to that last attempt by the Russians, the Breslov offensive, that they had no chance of recovering. Plus, they kept making stupid decisions trying to attack Italy, only to lose men because of, like, floods and avalanches and stupid things like that. Ultimately, they had nothing. They had next to no coal. They had next to no industry. Their transportation network was paralyzed. The population was miserable, hungry, and cold. Food riots began breaking out, and the government couldn't do anything about it. Now, the one thing that could have caused a complete revolution is if the government did not maintain censorship. Because news of what was happening on the fronts was not getting home. All the moms and dads and the wives heard was that, you know, their soldiers were fighting honorably. And they were continued to fight. And all you needed to do was tighten your belt a little harder. But truth be told, the army had nothing. They literally were forced to begin drafting men who literally had a pulse. The dregs. People who had been rejected in previous drafts because of medical issues or health issues. They were brought in. So literally, if you had a pulse and you could hold a rifle, you were brought into the military. Whether you could fight or not, you know, it's irrelevant. And rations were cut for the soldiers. They were surviving on less than a quarter pound of food a day. That's about a 20% reduction for what the soldiers were getting at the beginning of the war. They were on the verge of running out of potatoes, which was the main food supply that the army was fed. Uniforms, short supply. Literally, men were issued paper underwear. Wounds were dressed with paper bandages. And the army needed about 40,000 military police to arrest all of the deserters. Because men weren't just deserting by one or two or three, they were deserting by the thousands. And then, when Lenin took Russia out of the war, the first thing they did was send back the hundreds of thousands of POWs that they had. Actually, strike that. 1.5 million men were suddenly set back. Now, 500,000 had died in captivity, but these guys were physically and mentally broken. So they were starving and in need of medical attention, which there was none. But the scariest thing was, they came back with stories of how cruel the Tsar's government was to them, but how generous the Bolshevists were. And that maybe we should consider joining with Lenin and his boys, because they actually care about the common man. Oh yeah. But despite these realities, Commander-in-Chief Conrad is still there. What does he decide to do? Well, let's attack one more time. Being the true desk jockey that he was, he planned one more strike into the province of Vientia through the Alps. How did he do it? Well, like he formulated all his plans that we've been talking about whenever we talked about him. He used a map. And he made plans based upon what he saw upon the map. He called for using railroads to move the men and the supplies to the front. Never actually checking to see if the railroad lines were still there. Or checking to see if there was still fuel to power the railroads. He also had no idea of what levels of supplies were actually on hand. He had no inventory. So for instance, he says, send 500,000 rounds. Without actually checking if there were 500,000 rounds. He also ignored the fact that there was no accountability. So even if he asked, hey, do we have any coal to fire the railroads? There was no one who could even tell them. He just assumed, I have a map, I have the willpower, I'm going to make an order, and it's going to happen. So what did this mean? No trains, no food. The men were forced to carry whatever they had on their backs. Going through the Alps. In the late spring, when all of the snows start melting. And the snow on the mountains, what happens when it starts to melt? It falls. And to make matters even better, he said once they get into Italy, they're going to march easily down to Venice. Because I order them to. But you know what he didn't notice? That there actually was a major river in between where his men were marching and Venice that had to be forded. And unfortunately, as the snows melted in the mountains, they all came down the river, making the river impenetrable. So what ended up happening? The Austrians got separated. The advance units that crossed the river before the floods were separated from the rear units, which made easy targets for the Italians to wipe them out. Now here's the irony. On July 15th, he was finally dismissed. But as his rewards for his abilities, I like this photo. He wasn't fired and locked up, placed on, charges. No. He was made a count. He was given a palace and a life stipend. Which, of course, his wife loved, because now she could cover herself in diamonds and pearls and furs. Yeah. Well, beginning in July, day after day, the army slowly began to disintegrate. From July to September, 50% of the men deserted. Ironically, the Italians quietly watched the soldiers just leave their positions. And in some instances, the Italians actually raced up and caught up to them and gave them food and gave them supplies. When the Italian officers got word of what they were doing, needless to say, those Italian soldiers got in trouble. So to firm up, on October 24th, they ordered the Italians to actually attack the Austrians. But within a week, the Austrians withdrew from every square inch of Italian territory and pulled back into the homeland. 500,000 men simply put up their hands and surrendered. Austria would agree to an armistice on November 4th. Germany is now left alone, but we know what happens. But, just as a fun last click, the war wasn't over, at least in Africa. Nope. Because 3 days after Armistice Day, the hero of the German army, General Letzo Vorbeck, launched the last attack on November 13th and seized the city of Kazama in modern Rhodesia. After which, when he arrived and captured the city, he was told by the British government official, Germany agreed to an armistice 2 days ago. But at least Germany got the last victory. Questions? Alright, so this is it. Like I told you, the video will be put open as soon as I get home. It's lengthy, but I finished the class. Alright, so I will deal with the Peace of Paris, and by the end you'll know what happened to all of the countries that technically were the losers. Give yourself time to watch it all the way through. Give yourself time to study. All of the audio recordings will be up in place. So if you've missed any of the classes, you'll be able to hear what you missed. Obviously, the final exam is Tuesday. It's worth 35% of your final grade. So if you're gonna swing for the fences, this is the time to do so. All right? Please do not forget to take the final. I'm not gonna track you down. If you don't take it, you'll get a goose egg. All right?
Sure.
Thank you all. Hopefully we'll see you in the fall. Even Busra.